The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Lung cancer and paraneoplastic syndromes is presented by Dr. Amita Vasoya.
All right, this is a huge topic, which I'm going to try to do in 30 minutes. A lot of the slides are more informational so that you can use them hopefully to study. I'm going to focus on small cell and non-small cell, and then talk a little bit about, thank you. And then talk a little bit about management treatment, and then solitary pulmonary nodules, what do we do with them, and then go into the paraneoplastic syndromes that you're likely to be tested on. Lung cancer, as you know, is the most common cause of mortality worldwide, and I'm always impressed by this slide here because it far surpasses colon, breast, pancreas, and prostate. It accounts for 1.3 million deaths per year, and there are new cases every year, about 226 in 2012. The incidence for males has been relatively on the decline, although not as fast as we would hope. And then for females, it's relatively plateaued. It's not really changed much. It hasn't decreased dramatically over time. The five-year survival rates are poor for lung cancer when you compare them to the survival rates over time for prostate, colorectal, and breast. The red line you see is back in the 1970s, and then the blue is in the 2000s. So you can see when we approach the year 2000s, 2008 and whatnot, the survival rates have increased for prostate, colorectal, and breast, and not so much for lung cancer. So we have a lot of work to do. The death rates obviously have been on the decline, but still higher than the other cancers that I mentioned, and plateaued for females. As far as the risk factors, smoking is the most common risk factor for lung cancer, but don't forget environmental exposures, radon, air pollution, metals. We often see people that have never smoked a cigarette have cancer, and that could be due to exposures, asbestos, genetics. HIV is a risk factor, as is pulmonary fibrosis and radiation therapy. Lung cancer encompasses all tumors which arise from the bronchi, bronchioles, alveoli, and other respiratory epithelium. The mesotheliomas, lymphomas, sarcomas, they're distinct from the epithelial-derived cancers. So when we look at lung cancer, they look at the primary lung cancers, bronchogenic, you have carcinoid, you have adenoid cystic carcinoma, mucoepidermoid. I don't think they'll focus on the adenoid cystic and the mucoepidermoid, but bronchogenic and carcinoid are fair game. Soft tissue tumors like sarcomas and then metastatic tumors. Tumors can metastasize to the lung and then lung can metastasize elsewhere. When we look at bronchogenic carcinoma, we generally think of it, we divided it in small cell and non-small cell. In the small cell category, you have subdivisions, classic small cell, large cell, neuroendocrine, and then combined. For non-small cell, you have squamous cell, adenocarcinoma, and previously termed at bronchoalveolar cell is now atypical adenomatous hyperplasia, adenocarcinoma in situ, and minimally invasive adenocarcinoma. And then you have large cell. According to WHO classification, 88% of all lung neoplasms are made up of one of the four listed there, small cell, squamous cell, adeno, and large. Adenocarcinoma is the most frequent. Oops. Classically, small cell is central in nature radiographically. Two-thirds are perihilar or hilar. 1/6 can be involved in the main bronchus, and then some very few can be peripheral or apical. But for the most part, they are centrally located tumors. They are the most aggressive tumors of all of them and have a rapid doubling time. Early metastasis is often seen even by the time they get to diagnosis. The metastases are all usually present. Liver, bone, and CNS are the most common sites, and there's a strong association with tobacco use. There is early response to therapy, however, later on it does become refractory, and these people have 5-year survival rate that is very, very low, probably 5 to 10%. When we look at small cell, it's divided into limited stage and extensive stage. And limited stage usually is probably 30% of people will present in this stage. The majority usually present with extensive stage. The survival time, five-year survival for limited stage is about 10 to 15%, and then the 5-year survival for the extensive stage is 1 to 2%. So pretty aggressive tumor, and without treatment, it's even more aggressive, 2 to 4 months. So very important to catch these people early. It can present as paraneoplastic syndromes, ectopic ADH secretion, ACTH, Lambert-Eaton it can be seen as well. The treatment for these patients is chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and prophylactic cranial irradiation. If you want to attain complete response. But survival is not related to stage, and these tumors are aggressive. Surgery is usually not an option in these patients. Pathologically, you will see small blue cells. The buzzword is probably crush artifact, extensive necrosing that you would see on the path sides. I know when I was training, blue is bad, so if you see a whole lot of blue, that's bad. Non-small cell cancer, the first one I'll talk about is squamous cell. It has the best prognosis of the major cell types. Its common presentation is a large central mass with obstructive symptoms. It can cavitate in some situations, in some cases. It's locally invasive but can metastasize as well. Has an intermediate growth rate. Again, it's associated with smoking. Previously, it was thought that the phenomenon hypertrophic pulmonary osteoarthropathy was common, but it's not as common as it was thought of previously. Hypercalcemia can be seen in these patients. And the path slide that's, classic for squamous cell, you will see intercellular bridging, nesting formation, keratinization, and the keratin pearls is the buzzword that you would want to look for. And let me see if I can point that pearl out to you. This thing here. Adenocarcinoma usually presents peripherally. It may metastasize widely even before symptoms begin. It's usually not related to smoking, but it can be related. But a lot of times, it is the most common type of bronchogenic carcinoma in non-smokers. So that's fair game for testing. It's a slow-growing tumor, but it can invade the lymphatics and the blood vessels. And it can develop around scar tissue as well. Usually it's peripheral in nature, and then you have the path slide for adenocarcinoma. The classic features are the glandular nature, so that's really what you would be looking for. Here are the glands. All of the path specimens, the pathologist will do immunoperoxidase staining, and this is probably not going to be tested for internal medicine boards, but know that there are special stains that are sent, and classically for small cell, it's usually chromogranin and NSE positive staining. Adenocarcinoma in situ, again, peripheral in nature, can have a ground glass or infiltrative appearance. So very important if you have an X-ray and the patient doesn't act like pneumonia, it may not be pneumonia, it could be cancer, so keep that in mind. And it's also one of the biggest reasons why we follow X-rays till resolution of the infiltrate, so that we're not missing any type of cancer. Adenocarcinoma in situ follows lipidic growth, tumor cell lines along the alveolar walls. The subtypes, you're probably not going to be tested on. I listed there just for completeness sake. And there is a high incidence with tobacco use, 30 to 40% are non-smokers. This is pretty impressive. It's a it looks very infiltrative nature. You have some areas of consolidation in here versus up here. But if you treat this patient as pneumonia with antibiotics, et cetera, and they don't get better, definitely they would buy themselves a lung biopsy. Large cell carcinoma, 95% are undifferentiated. They usually present as large masses, centrally located. It's fairly uncommon. It comprises about 3% of all lung cancers, has a rapid growth, and can metastasize early. There is a variant, the giant cell variant, which is even more lethal, and the mean survival is less than 6 months. Again, there's large cells that are seen on past slide. Other types of cancer, you have your bronchial gland tumors, you have adenoid cystic tumor, mucoepidermoid. Those are probably not going to be tested, but I will focus a little bit on the carcinoid tumors, which are, I think are fair game, the typical and atypical carcinoids. They are bronchial neuroendocrine tumors. They're relatively indolent clinical behavior. GI is the most common site, lung is the second. They represent 1 to 5% of all lung tumors, and they present, the patients are usually younger in age at presentation, and it can be subclassified into the typical and the atypical carcinoid. The typical carcinoid is usually low-grade, well-differentiated, slow-growing tumor. It rarely metastasizes, but it can cause endobronchial obstruction, which is one of the presenting features. They can present with a cough that really just doesn't go away, and then you scope them and you see this big tumor in their airway. Atypical is intermediate grade tumor with a higher mitotic rate and or necrosis. They usually arise centrally or peripherally. They rarely exceed 3 to 4 centimeters in diameter. And again, they have this palisading rosette or ribbon-like arrangement. It looks kind of pretty if you ask me. But anyway, the clinical manifestations, they come from the intraluminal growth. Most of the bronchial carcinoids are non-secretory and don't metastasize, but some are rarely functional and capable of producing the carcinoid syndrome, which includes diarrhea, flushing, and cyanosis. And again, some of the presenting features could be cough that doesn't go away. These tumors are vascular, so they can complain of hemoptysis or present with hemoptysis, or if they have a post-obstructive infection, they can present with a post-obstructive type pneumonia. Atelectasis, the atelectasis doesn't have to be overwhelming and obvious. Sometimes it's just subtle atelectasis. You can have slight elevation of the right hemidiaphragm if the tumor is in the bronchus headed down to the right lower lobe. So it doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to slap you in the face. It can be subtle findings. It's amenable to resection, so this is a classic appearance of a carcinoid tumor, and they're very vascular, so if you poke at it, it can bleed, and the treatment is to resect them. Some fun facts while you're watching Jeopardy or taking the exam. Due to an enormous variance in history, the therapeutic response requires a histologic diagnosis. So all these people need you need pathology. Over 25 years, adenocarcinoma has become the histologic subtype most frequently associated with both sexes, all races, and has replaced squamous cell. And it is the most common tumor seen in your non-smoking population and your young women. Again, small cell and epidermoid cancers are central masses. Adenocarcinoma and large cell are more peripheral in location. Pancoast tumor is superior sulcus tumor right up in here. It can present with Horner syndrome if there's compression. You have you have ptosis, meiosis, and hidrosis. If you have compression, you can have brachial plexus symptoms. And then you can also have erosion, local erosion of the vertebra. So keep that in mind if you have a tumor way up high. Superior vena cava syndrome, over 95% are caused by malignancy. 5 to 10% are usually lymphomas. Predominantly small cell or squamous cell lung cancer. It's not as big of an emergency as it was previously thought. And again, the approach to treatment is listed there. So you want to institute therapy early, usually radiation. This is an example of a huge tumor burden compressing the superior vena cava. You can hardly see the vessels. They're pretty much squashed. Metastasis can be seen, obviously, as with any kind of cancer. Every organ system is susceptible to lung cancer metastasis. Brain, bone, spinal cord, liver are the more common ones. You want to, obviously, when you find someone with lung cancer, you want to do a PET scan and an MRI of their brain to make sure there's no other mets. Adrenal mets are common, but they rarely cause adrenal insufficiency. So when we clinically evaluate these patients, you want to stage the patient clinically and pathologically. Obviously, HMP is where we always start. Evaluate their symptoms. Is it a cough that's new? Is it changed from your patient with chronic bronchitis cough? That's very important to know. Hemoptysis is an important thing to identify. Exposures, on any constitutional symptoms, such as weight loss. You can start with a chest x-ray and proceed with a CAT scan of the chest if there are any abnormalities. And even if there aren't any abnormalities and their symptoms are not going away you're not satisfied with a chest x-ray, obviously you want to go ahead and do the chest CT. PET scan is also necessary to evaluate for mets and do the staging workup, and an MRI of the brain. Before, if the PET scan is not available, you could CT them head to toe and do a bone scan. Review of prior films is very, very important. You want to ask these patients, do they have prior imaging to compare with? Because you want to evaluate, is this old, is this new, has this been there 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or did it just pop up within the last 6 months? Very important thing to ask about and look for. And you need tissue diagnosis. And the modalities by which you obtain them depend on where your tumor is and how easily accessible it is with the least risk, posing the least risk to the patient. Bronchoscopy is one of the modalities that we usually start with. But if the tumor is in the mediastinum or it's way peripheral, certainly mediastinoscopy or VATS thoracotomy is an option. Some of the newer modalities available is endobronchial ultrasound, which you can naturally get lymph node tissue samples while you're doing your bronchoscopy and getting your peripheral, getting your biopsy of your mass as well. And then you have navigational bronchoscopy, which can be used for lesions that are about 8 to 10 millimeters in diameter. And if they're very peripheral, it uses GPS mapping. It's kind of like playing a computerized video game in real life with real patients. You do the scope, and then through it, the computer and the CAT scan locate where the lesion is, and they guide you directly with your scope and your catheter that's within the scope to the location where you can actually get the biopsy that's way peripheral, which you would never get with the traditional bronchoscopy. PET scan is a whole body scan. That's the details about it. I won't belabor the point, but essentially you want to look for uptake in abnormal areas, FDG uptake, to signify that there is a concern in that area. Now, it may not everything that lights up on a PET scan is malignant, so be careful. There are false positives, false negatives with it. A lot of times, patients can be asymptomatic. It could be a preoperative x-ray, look what we found kind of finding, or they can, majority do present with symptoms such as cough, weight loss, dyspnea, chest discomfort, hemoptysis. Unexplained bone pain certainly deserves evaluation. And then you have hoarseness, vocal cord hoarseness, if the laryngeal nerve is involved. So things of that sort be on the lookout. I think we'll skip that. As far as screening, the latest guidelines recommend low-dose CAT scan in all your smokers that have a 30-pack year history. We quit within the last 15 years, and age is 55 to 78, I believe it is now. So you want these; they get a yearly low-dose CAT scan to evaluate. The chest x-rays are no longer recommended. In terms of treatment, I will briefly touch on it. I don't know if that. I think generally you should just have the idea of whether chemotherapy, radiation therapy is indicated, or whether they're a surgical candidate or not. I think that's fair game. The nitty-gritty details is probably not going to be tested in terms of what stage requires what treatment and whatnot. So for a small cell, limited stage rate. Usually, generally for small cell surgery is not an option. It's usually chemotherapy and radiation, and prophylactic cranial irradiation is also an option as well, or present it to the patient. For stage one and two, these people are usually resectable, and sometimes they will get postoperative adjuvant chemotherapy for stage two and 2B. And for patients that don't, that refuse chemotherapy or are not candidates, you can try radiation. Stage three, 3A, is the combined modality approach, chemotherapy followed by surgery, followed by chemo, post-op chemo or radiation. And then stage 3B, surgery is not an option. So stage 1, 2, and 3A, potentially you can have, 3A potentially can be surgically resected, and 3B and forward are not. Stage 4, chemotherapy palliative treatment is usually the only option for these patients. And metastatic, obviously, they are not candidates for surgery. Laser therapy, if there is obstruction, obviously chemotherapy in certain situations, as I mentioned. Tyrosine kinase inhibitors, just a word or two, they're newer on the forefront, but they are being used in the treatment for cancer. And so that is another option in our armamentarium. Solitary pulmonary nodules, just a word about that. Basically, it's a nodule that presents on an X-ray, and then it's one nodule, and you don't know what to do with it. It's usually about a centimeter, maybe 35% of lesions are malignant. The majority may or majority are not. So the question is when to resect or not resect. And usually, you know, if they're resectable, my feeling is, you know, if you're in doubt, take it out. The following favor resection: if they're young and otherwise healthy and can tolerate surgery, certainly you can take it out. If it's a large lesion, if they lack calcification, you want to take it out. If you find that it's growing, definitely it comes out. A lack of growth over a two-year period of time would indicate benign nature, but that's just something that, you know, we're taught. But I've seen tumors grow beyond 2 years, so you don't always want to, you know, say stop imaging at 2 years and be done with it. You want to keep an eye on these patients. I keep an eye on it. On them for a lot longer. I've seen tumors grow over a four-year period of time. So patients don't follow the cookbooks. If they have a dense central nidus, punctate calcification, or popcorn-appearing calcification, that would suggest benign lesion. Eccentric calcification is more malignant, so look for that. And this I put in because I know on every single test, something along the way asks about what mediastinal mass is found in the anterior mediastinum, middle mediastinum, and posterior. So you can study that on your time. Benign lung lesions comprise of less than 5% of tumors. Again, they can be adenomas, hematomas, chondromas, fibromas, any OMA you want to come up with. So for the benign lung neoplasms, they can present with airway obstruction, cough, hemoptysis, the same symptoms as the malignant patients. If there's a central mass, potentially they can be resected. They may or may not be visible on the X-ray, so, you know, additional testing is necessary. Most of the adenomas are, most of bronchial adenomas, OMAs, bronchial adenomas are 80%, they're central, they're slow growing, they're generally benign, most of them are carcinoids, and those you want to resect. And I'll just go through this. We talked about carcinoid. Hematomas is another benign tumor. The peak incidence is age 60, generally with a preponderance in males, but you could see hematomas in anybody. Generally, they they are comprised of fat and calcium. Usually, the classic appearance is the popcorn calcification that you would see. And if you have additional risk factors that say, well, maybe this could be malignant, maybe it's not as popcorny or central as, you know, I think it is, then certainly you may want to do a biopsy or even just take it out. But generally, they're usually in the lower lobes. They're usually, you could see that at the base of the diaphragm. This right here looks almost, it's dense with calcium. Switching to paraneoplastic syndromes, I'm not going to go through every single slide in detail, but because I put a lot of the information there just to be complete and so that it can be useful for your studies. Some of the paraneoplastic syndromes, SIADH, we often see it causes hyponatremia, primarily seen in small cell. ACTH-producing Cushing syndrome, again in small cell. Hypercalcemia can be seen classically in squamous cell. And you can also see digital clubbing or hypertrophic pulmonary osteoarthropathy, usually non-small cell cancer. Eaton-Lambert, small cell. Peripheral neuropathies can be seen usually in small cell. And you can see other, you can see subacute cerebellar degeneration, dermatomyositis, polymyositis. But this is just a list of the different paraneoplastic syndromes that we can see. The pathogenesis of paraneoplastic syndromes is an aberrant release of humoral mediators. The occurrence is in about 10% of patients with cancer. And its expression really may precede the diagnosis. So if you have someone come in with unexplained hyponatremia, certainly that would warrant further evaluation. We talked about endocrine tumors. Look for the systemic features as well, not just the constitutional symptoms. You want to look for malnutrition, electrolyte disturbances, things of that sort, anemia, clubbing, all of those things to clue you in as to paraneoplastic involvement. Some of the endocrine features, Cushing syndrome is listed there. It can be seen in the lung carcinomas that I mentioned. Small cell carcinoma, bronchial carcinoid is the more common one that we would see it in. And then just in terms of what you would do to make the diagnosis, I just listed there, and the treatment, which we can go through. Again, hypercalcemia is seen in squamous cell, related to parathyroid hormone-related peptide. And then the therapy there. SIADH is seen in small cell. Only 1 to 2% of small cell patients have SIADH. So, but keep it in mind. It is more common than I thought before. So you want to look for it, identify it, and treat it. And then the other hematologic features are listed there. These patients are at risk for thrombotic disease. They can get migratory thrombophlebitis, PEs, thrombosis. Keep that in mind as well. Some of the most some neurologic syndromes can be seen. Again, as I mentioned, Eaton-Lambert, where you have proximal muscle weakness, and then the treatment is listed there. I think the rest is probably too much. But, and that's all.